You know, the sort of the bizarre visual effects that I had along the way as I lost my sight were really eye-opening, if you'll pardon the pun, in the sense that, you know, I think we assume, I certainly did, that, you know, sight is this sort of passive, immediate thing, and, you know, you see the world or whatever, and then here I am, you know, where sight in my world is this arduous process, and it's frustrating, and objects appear and morph and disappear and all this stuff, and you realize, like, this is all happening in my brain. And then you read more about it, and you know, I could go on and on this subject, so I'll try to keep it brief. But you know, you realize I have constructed this immersive experience that I perceive as a direct representation of the world around me, and it's totally not. And for me, the sort of the aha moment was linking that right there in that occupational therapist's office that day, linking that to the way I had experienced my fears. And it was like, well, wait a minute. I have been living in this awfulized world, making all these baseless assumptions about what my life is going to be like, and I've experienced it as truth, the same way we experience sight as truth, and it's just not.
This is the Angles of Latitude podcast, session number 102, with the author of the New York Times bestseller book, Eyes Wide Open, Isaac Lidsky.
This is squadron leader confirming hostiles inbound. Prepare for battle.
What you're about to hear is the integration of life.
Clarity is power.
If you live each day as if it was your last, someday you'll most certainly be right.
Liberty.
We choose to go to the moon.
It's happening.
And all things geek.
Yeah, I'm not sure I know how to answer that.
You got a badass over here.
Welcome to the Angles of Latitude podcast.
Hey guys and gals, welcome back to the show. I'm your host, JC Preston, and with me in this session as co-host is Albert Winks, President of Ascension. And if you're new to the audience, this is the show which we release each Thursday, where we bring you life lessons or a message from successful entrepreneurs, experts, and artists to help you do your life's work and live a lifestyle that you're proud of. Today's guest is someone that I'm thrilled to actually bring to you guys. And you know, he's had a heck of a career spanning from being a child actor to being a successful entrepreneur in his own right to even serving as a law clerk under two Supreme Court justices. And today he owns a pretty successful construction business and is author of a book you might have heard of called Eyes Wide Open. His name is Isaac Lidsky. Now, in this session, Albert and I don't do the run-of-the-mill interview. You know, we skip most of the, well, tell me about the book, or, you know, tell me about your time as a child actor type questions. While we do have a little bit of that in there about that kind of stuff, we figured that we could better serve you guys by finding out answers to more of the behind-the-scenes questions. You know, I personally heard him pop up a couple of times in some shows that I'll include in the show notes, but there were some questions that I had that just went unanswered in each of the interviews that I heard. And so Al and I set out to actually find out some of those answers. So in this chat, you'll hear more about how Isaac seemingly went to one career to another and suddenly popping up on a stage at a TED Talk and doing so well with his book. We also discuss how Isaac came to realize that fear distorts reality and how what he believes helped him grow his construction company to the size it is today. And finally, you'll learn how mentorship and having people in his life who have been there before have really helped him get to where he's at. And before we get into this one, I want to remind you guys about Read It For Me. Since we're on the topic of books, remember that Read It For Me has tons of book summaries available anytime you want them. And you know, personally, I'm horrible at reading and picking up others' content anymore. And in fact, it's the one reason I make sure that when I'm doing yard work, I'm at least listening to a podcast, because it just, honestly, I mean, that's when I have time to bring in more content these days, because most of the time that I'm producing my own. And you know, you're you'll be like thinking, well, dude, if you're listening to a podcast, can't you listen to an audiobook version of, you know, said books or whatever? And I'm like, okay, I like the idea, but the thing with audiobooks, at least for me, is that they usually have a great point in them, and I'd still have to write those points down. You know, and that's pretty much the reason I'm a member of Read It For Me, because they already have those points written down, and they've made videos of them, and they've made audios of them. So, you know, Read It For Me is the number one book summary service for entrepreneurs, executives, and those that want to be one someday. And if you're like me and you hear about all these great books that are, you know, being released all the time, but you find yourself with limited time to read them, the place is definitely for you. And having started as a way to build traffic, which is a service they provide if you want to still use it for your own social media, it has grown to be a vast library of business and success book summaries. And these 12-minute summaries are available as video, audio, or text. And I mean, these things are so well put together that if you are in the business of doing presentations on a regular basis, you could use them part of those presentations if you'd want to. So they're definitely a great tool for coaches, or if you simply have clients you want to build better relationships with, it makes great tools as well. Or if you're looking for ways to help out, improve your workforce, companies like Zappos, American Express, BMO Bank, Cornell University, and many others use their services as training for their employees. So anyway, go over to newinceptions.com/readitforme. You can get your free membership today, normally valued at $10 a month. This particular membership provides you with text summaries daily so you can learn while you're on the go. And again, that's newinceptions.com/readitforme. Anyway, let's get into this one, guys. Show notes and show note extras can be found at newinceptions.com/102. And of course, I'll be on after the show to fill you in on anything we might have missed. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the show. Today, I'm joined with co-host Albert Winks, president of Ascension Mentorship. And I think we're going to have a great show for you today. Today, we have on the show someone that Glenn Beck has described as the I guess you could say the Forrest Gump of success, and starting out as a young child actor and doing advertising, and he then worked his way up to into the chain to be on reboot of one of the most popular kids shows back in the 1990s. And I believe he is a great example of the old saying, when the going gets tough, the tough gets going. And about the same time that he landed on NBC's Saved by the Bell, the new class, he learned that he had a degenerative disease of the eyes, and where he would eventually lose his sight pixel by pixel, as he has mentioned in several recent interviews. But that didn't stop him. He would go on to start an internet advertising company, and after leaving that, would go on into law school, working at the federal level after graduating. After becoming tired of being in law, he then would go on to buy a struggling construction company and making it worth 10 times as more as what it was worth when he first bought it, and then becoming a thought leader with his new book, Eyes Wide Open. Oh, and did I mention he's the father of triplets, only 37, and he's a TED speaker as well. Today's guest is Isaac Litsky. Welcome to the show, man. How you doing?
Excellent. How about you?
Oh man, doing great. Can't complain. Looking outside, great, nice, sunny July day. And yeah, man, to tell you the truth, I've been looking forward to having this conversation for a while. So glad to have you on. And you know, I actually heard you on several podcasts already. And you know, I think I know your story. I think a lot of people might know your story as well. And so one of the things that I'm looking forward to doing today is kind of having a part two of the conversation. And for those people who don't know too much about your story, what I'm going to do is actually include a lot of the links of, you know, the different interviews that you've been on, so they can kind of fill in the gap without us having to re-go through a lot of that conversation. So one of the things that, you know, you had talked about on the other interviews is that you started as a child actor. And I'm really curious, is like, how did you get into child acting in the first place? Did you have anybody that, any mentors or anybody, or did you like have someone that, you know, you could rely on to actually give you information on how to do that? I'm kind of curious how you got to get started there.
Sure. So I have three older sisters. I grew up, the youngest of four, the only boy. I was the king of my house. And so my oldest sister, when she was real little, would point at the TV and say she wanted to be on it. And so my mom started researching ways that she might help her make that happen in Miami, Florida. And one thing led to another, and my sisters did some acting in commercials and whatnot. And by the time I was born, my mom was, in essence, a pro in the business, knew all the agents and managers. So I did a diaper commercial when I was 6 months old, and it was basically downhill from there. I did somewhere between 100 and 150 commercials growing up.
Wow.
Really thought that everybody acted. As a kid, there are stories of times when I was confused or frustrated when, friends would say they were going to play after school, and I insisted, no, there's an audition after school. What are you talking about? Anyway, eventually I realized that this was an uncommon childhood experience.
Wow.
So you were on Saved by the Bell like one season. I'm not too familiar with the show, so I don't know how long it actually lasted, but what made you leave? I mean, that seemed like a pretty good gig to me.
So I think the new class was on for a good six or seven seasons.
Was it? Okay.
I could be wrong on that. I was essentially, trying to sort of figure out how to move on in light of my diagnosis and kind of what the game plan looked like for me. And, pretty quickly determined that acting was not going to be a great career for me. Well, I thought it was a lot of fun. I didn't necessarily think it was the right business and didn't necessarily suit my my personality. And of course, the impending blindness really sort of changed things.
Okay, gotcha. So you kind of outgrew the hand-me-down career, as it were, from...
Yeah, I guess that's a good... I've never put it that way, but that's exactly right. I kind of, I guess, maybe opened... popped my head up and opened my eyes and realized, wait a minute, this is not the life I want for myself.
And again, so early on to be able to become aware that that's not what you wanted. I mean, when I was in second grade, I knew that I wanted to be an engineer, but... once I got to doing my first couple of internships, it was like, why did I spend so much time in college going after this?
Yeah.
So another thing that I'm wondering about is, from the rest of your teen years and early 20s, I'm kind of curious as to what was going on during that time. And for many, I mean, this is considered the whatever years, but you seem to have used it as more of a springboard for the rest of your life. And I mean, you could have become a normal Joe like so many child actors do, but you didn't. I mean, first, you chose to study mathematics at Harvard. I mean, why go there? Were you originally from the East Coast? If you were from Miami, right? Did that background help you start your first company? I mean, there's a lot of other little questions there.
One of my three older sisters studied at Harvard as well, and I visited her there a handful of times and quickly fell in love with the place and really wanted to study there myself. So off I went. I actually was sort of ahead of the traditional path in school anyway. I sort of started school early and then skipped a grade or two, and then found myself wanting to move on from Los Angeles and go on to college with only a slight problem. I was a junior in high school. So I applied to college as a junior in LA and wrote a letter to explain why I wanted to go off to school early. And anyway, it ultimately panned out. So I wound up graduating from Harvard College when I was 19. Mm-hmm. And, in terms of what to study, I always loved math and really enjoyed studying it, and then kind of took a computer science course on the side and fell in love with that too. And to me, they're all kind of related in the way of being sort of modes of thought, right? Modes of critical thinking, problem solving, analysis, perspectives, ways to approach a problem or think about the world. And a third that I was very interested in was law. My father, he's retired now, but he was an attorney, and I used to love going to work with him and seeing him in action in court, and I always wanted to get that sort of a persuasive, critical thinking, sort of argumentative, way of problem solving. I wanted to get that under my belt as well. So I'd always thought I wanted to go to law school, and I was planning to go straight off when My brother-in-law approached me and asked if I wanted to join him and start this internet advertising technology business. Mm. So I did that for a couple of years, and then wound up going back to law school, and you know, away we go.
Gotcha. And back then, like, the craze today is Facebook ads, but you're talking what, like banners and kinds of things like that, or what?
Yeah, I mean, it was primarily the banner ad, and you know, or other type of ads on websites. And it was in the very, very early days, and there was all this talk about the promise of one-to-one marketing, right? Like, we can actually choose what ad to show this particular user or viewer based on, you know, their attributes. And moreover, we can even, you know, conceivably tailor the content in real time. And there was a lot of talk about that and its promise, but no one was actually doing it. So we set out to do it, and you know, I'm really proud of the team and the company and the software, wound up being among the first to really dynamically allocate and sort of populate advertising content.
Wow. So did Facebook buy you guys, or buy that company to make the Facebook Pixel? So
I worked for the company for a couple years, and then we kind of raised institutional money and hired our own bosses, and it became like a real job, which I was never interested in. So that's when I made my exit for law school. Right. Years later, the business wound up selling for $230 million.
Jeez.
To another ad tech company. And it's funny because I tell the story in my book. You know, old friends reached out to congratulate me, and you know, random, you know, realtors and stockbrokers and whatever started, you know, lighting up my phone, and everyone assumed that I was this mega millionaire all of a sudden. The truth of the matter is I didn't make a penny on that transaction. Mm-hmm. But I am nonetheless, you know, proud of what it suggests for what we built.
Because, I mean, that sounds like a great lead in into how Facebook got their technology for the Pixel. So, I mean, was that anyhow related to that? Or, I mean, how were you guys following that stuff back in the day?
Yeah, there was a lot of pixels and tracking. We built a little piece of technology we colloquially called the research assistant, which would glean things like, you know, IP address, what type of hardware the person's using, what type of internet connection they have, which tends to be pretty important if you're deciding whether to serve them a rich media ad or a plain old, you know, banner ad, or at least it mattered back then for the performance of the ad. And you start putting enough of those things together with some smart math and some you know, good creative ideas, and you know, all of a sudden internet advertising starts to actually work, which I mean, frankly, I'll be honest with you, I was even it even surprised me how well the stuff started to work, to improve the efficacy of ad campaigns. So it was exciting. It was very fun.
Cool.
I should say my brother-in-law Joe Zawadzki went on to found a second business called MediaMath. Which is now like the titan of programmatic advertising online. I'm super proud of him and what he's built and his team. So
awesome. Well, that's cool.
That's very cool.
Al, did you have anything you want to interject yet?
Oh man, you're Isaac, it's great chatting with you. You are all over the page in good ways, and we're cut from the same cloth. So yeah, I can definitely appreciate that. So as I'm listening to you guys, it's like, man, I've got all kinds of questions of how did you get from left foot here to right foot there? And I definitely want, and I know JC and I both want to value your time and be able to talk to you about things that you really want to talk about. So definitely help guide us if we start veering off in a direction that you want to pull back from. But yeah, we're cut from the same cloth, man. I actually turned 37 tomorrow, and I went from everything being a gymnast when I was younger, teacher for 13 years as an elite level gymnast instructor, to a helicopter pilot in the Army and flying hundreds of combat missions and things of that nature, to now being an entrepreneur. So people look at us and say, oh, now it makes sense that you have so many experiences. But as we're doing it, right, they're looking at us like we're crazy. Wait, how did you go from gymnastics to helicopters in the Army? So, I'm sure you get the weird looks every now and then, too. So I'd like to hear a little bit more about your experience growing up that way as well.
It's funny you say that because, yeah, you know, you look at just the list of stuff and it seems somewhat, bizarre or inexplicable, but I tell people each decision along the way seemed to make sense at the time.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
That's really the only answer.
Yeah. I get that too.
Another thing that you'd mentioned was that you'd seen the doctor that gave you the prognosis really helped you determine how you can confront the situation rather than be a victim of things. Can you go into detail a bit more about this? Because I think that a lot, I would agree with that. This was definitely your pivot point. And I want to also say that because it was so early in life, maybe it's given you a much more time to develop your self-awareness, where other people, they're just going with the flow of what society is expecting them to do. And then they might eventually think about it.
Yeah, I think you're right. I you know, am the first to say that going blind in many ways was one of the best things that ever happened to me. And I mean it quite literally, with, you know, a great deal of nuance and thought and you know, precision. It's not just something that I say lightly. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, I was diagnosed when I was 13 and was you know, immediately thrust into the grips of some, you know, visceral fear, and was convinced for several years that blindness was going to absolutely ruin my life. In a remarkable way, that sort of process of losing my sight, the bizarre experience I had, gave me this real insight into how we create the realities we experience, mm-hmm. and things that we think are out there and objective and truth, like, for example, what we see, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. are in reality, you know, machinations of our minds. That we are empowered to control and shape, or certainly at least be aware of. So where that really clicked in, the sort of eureka moment I think you're speaking of, is when I went to see a low vision rehabilitation specialist, an occupational therapist. Mm. And I still had a good deal of useful sight. And I wasn't really, you know, doing much to learn about the tools or technologies or techniques that were out there to make my life easier. I was kind of stuck in this world where blindness was this awful doom and gloom, dreadful scenario in the future, this monster, this sort of problem of tomorrow that, you know, would haunt me. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of pretty insistent that today's not a problem. Now I can handle, right? Just please God, don't let it get any worse. And you know, meanwhile, I go in to meet with this woman, and, you know, she asks me, you know, do you use a cane for the blind? And I'm thinking, you know, no, I don't use a cane yet. You know, I see too well for that. I'm thinking, aren't you supposed to be the expert lady? And you know, besides, it seems like an arbitrary detail, right? I'm not here. I don't care about the cane. I care about, you know, blindness, right? And she says, well, you know, do you bump into things? And I'm like, God, of course I bump into things, right? So I roll up my pants leg. I show her this ugly bruise. And, you know, I had walked into a fire hydrant a couple of days earlier.
Oh, man.
Very painful, literally split my pants against my shin.
Mm.
So I show her that, and, you know, I want her to understand how little I care about bumping into things, right? I'm like, you know, my problem is blindness tomorrow, the future, you know, all this awful stuff. Like, it's not bumping into things that I'm here to talk about. And then, you know, so she says to me, you know, if you used a cane, you probably wouldn't bump into things and hurt yourself. And it was a really obvious point, right? I mean, like, I got to admit, mm-hmm. it's a very obvious point. But it really led to an epiphany for me right in that moment. You know, cause I realized right then that, like, there is no tomorrow, an awful doom and gloom, and, you know, all the things we worry about down there. I mean, there's only right now, this moment. You know, and I realized that, you know, in that moment, everything I thought I knew about going blind or being blind was just, you know, lies, mm. born of fear, mm-hmm. and worse. You know, and in a sense, I was choosing to believe those lies, right? I hadn't done anything to learn about going blind or being blind. Mm. So that was a big moment for me when I said, you know what, I'm going to make a different choice. I'm going to take responsibility for who I am and how I want to live my life. I'm going to make those choices with awareness and intention, and I'm going to hold myself accountable for my choices.
Mm. That kind of trigger response, I was just down on a podcast myself. His name is Gregory Deal, and we kind of had a more of a rant than him interviewing me. We were just kind of ranting on the fact that it takes a pain point like that, or some sort of hardship. I think he thought so as well. That I don't know, taking an inventory of your life and where you're at and where you're currently going to, you know, to even make that course correction. Do you think it takes, like, a severe hardship or some sort of trauma or something to start being more self-aware? Or do you think someone can just you know, be told enough that, hey, you should start paying attention to your, to where you actually fit in the world, and then people can do it.
So I, you know, I fundamentally do not believe that it takes some traumatic event. And I, you know, I'm rather passionate about that. In my case, you know, I gained this vision through the process of going blind and mm-hmm. embracing that. And I call the vision, incidentally, like living eyes wide open or whatever. So for me, I learned to live eyes wide open sort of by going blind. But, you know, I write about it and I talk about it and I'm passionate about it because I'm convinced that it's something that anyone can do. For me, it really boils down to choice. And if you want to truly, deeply at your core, make the choice to live eyes wide open, then, you know, then you can. And I, you know, I'm doing my best to try to convince folks to make that choice.
Yeah, sure. And I think I'm jumping ahead in our conversation, but I think we'll come back around to it. But I do like a lot of stuff that you say, Isaac, here, even in your TED talk, of the fear distorts reality. I mean, that's, I love when people like yourself can take something very complex and really just move it and mush it down into a very simple term, kind of like your the nurse telling you to use a cane, you won't bump into things. I mean, yeah. It's, you know, or a doctor using that term, that, I mean, that's what most of life does boil down to, is just your own fear distorts reality. And maybe in a helicopter pilot, of course, we do literally get into a lot of visual illusions. And so we know a lot about that, literally, that most other common folk don't know about. And so when you said that line, I mean, I just instantly had to write it down, that it makes sense. And I'm sure that you and I would agree. And I'm curious to hear how you came to that concept yourself. And help share that concept with others, that fear does distort reality.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the sort of the bizarre visual effects that I had along the way as I lost my sight were really eye-opening, if you'll pardon the pun, in the sense that, you know, I think we assume, I certainly did, that, you know, sight is this sort of passive, immediate thing, and, you know, you see the world or whatever. And then here I am, you know, where sight in my world is this arduous process, and it's frustrating, and objects appear and morph and disappear and all this stuff. And you realize, like, this is all happening in my brain. And then you read more about it, and, you know, I could go on this subject. So I'll try to keep it brief, but basically, you know, you realize I have constructed this immersive, experience that I perceive as a direct representation of the world around me. And it's totally not. And for me, the sort of the aha moment was linking that right there in that occupational therapist's office that day, linking that to the way I had experienced my fears. Mm-hmm. And it was like, well, wait a minute. I have been living in this awfulized world, making all these baseless assumptions about what my life is going to be like. And I've experienced it as truth, the same way we experience sight as truth. And it's just not. So that's really what led me to start looking critically at, you know, the human experience, my experience, and trying to reason through all the other ways that we shape our own realities without necessarily knowing that we're doing it, right? So the self-limiting assumptions we make about ourselves,
right?
The way we perpetuate our own insecurities and vanities, the way we misconceive the force of luck in life and misperceive what success means and value means, our inability or difficulty in listening to each other and to our own hearts, and on and on and on. There's all sorts of ways in which we can, it's a cliche, but, you know, be our own worst enemies. And if you can gain that vision, if you can sort of recognize your role as the sort of master of your reality, man, it is empowering and liberating, and it has brought me just endless joy and fulfillment in my life and yeah. success in the way I define success. Mm-hmm. So this is what I mean when I say going blind was one of the best things that ever happened to me. But you don't have to go blind.
Yeah, exactly. You put a little disclaimer in there. Yes. You don't have to be blind or go blind to do that. No, yeah. And I totally agree. And this is why I say you and I are cut from the same cloth. That I grew up on a cattle ranch. I'm nobody's son and all that kind of stuff. I just, like I said, flew hundreds of missions and also just finished a master's degree that has a central focus on neuroscience. So when I hear folks like yourself saying these, taking these complex ideas and making them simple, I mean, it totally makes sense to me. And I know that that's a extreme focus within my company, Ascension, and us focusing on academies and things like that to help with our, through our curriculum, to help adult learners and help folks understand that they do have to they have to conquer themselves first before we can even train them, and damn sure before they can execute the program, they have to get over their fears, and we're here to help them do that. And that's through exactly what you're doing is really coming at it from a neuroscience perspective, having some scientific backing, but also just mushing all that stuff down to simple stuff. If you use a cane, you won't bump into shit. But sometimes it's the toughest thing in the world to do, isn't it? To market the take something so complex, but turn it into something so simple, and then you have to inject it into people. And I know that's our next part of the conversation here is how did you get to that point in your own personal and professional life to where you wanted to inject that into a book or a TED talk, or talk to me about that process in your life.
You know, I have long wanted to write a book to describe my vision for others. I'm convinced that it's a vision others can embrace. Others can see what I see. And I felt almost a calling, I wouldn't say responsibility, but certainly a deep desire to share it. Mm-hmm. I felt that way for years. Flash forward, had some children, in particular had three children at the same time, which doctors call triplets.
Yeah.
Started thinking about what I wanted to teach them. And at the time was sort of getting my current business off the ground, and we went through some real tough times. But, after 3-4 years of running my current business, my team and the business began to succeed beyond my wildest dreams, truly. Mm-hmm. And I figured now, and I had, great partners and team members who could take the company even further than I ever could. So I figured, now's the time for me to do this. So I kind of stepped back very, very intentionally, worked with my now the president of the company to work myself out of all the day-to-day responsibilities of the business and build some space there. And then I sat down and wrote the book largely for my children. Mm-hmm. They're still a little young, but I do hope someday they'll read it and understand the old man a little better. And hopefully it'll bring them the value and meaning in their life. Mm-hmm. Started really almost by accident, started speaking to some groups. I'm a member of an organization called YPO, the Young Presidents Organization, and mm-hmm. some of my buddies there asked me to, hey, would you talk to us about, how you run your business being blind? And then, another chapter said, hey, would you talk to us? And one thing led to another, and I realized I really enjoyed also speaking to folks as a keynote speaker or whatever. And mm-hmm. wound up doing the TED talk, and here we are. So it's kind of just been this momentum. I'm immensely gratified by the positive reaction to the TED talk and the book. My book, Eyes Wide Open, was a New York Times bestseller, which is very rewarding and gratifying, like I said. But at the same time, I will not lose sight of the reason why I'm doing this, which really is truly to share the vision, to try to convince folks to maybe see themselves and their lives the way I view myself and mine. Mm-hmm. And, so long as I feel like I'm making progress on that front, I'll keep doing it.
Yeah. 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 And definitely congratulations on all that. That's definitely awesome stuff. And I have five kids myself, so I definitely know what it's like to have a house full. And I'm curious to think of, like you said, having that connection with the kiddos, with your book, and having them connect with you, the old man at some point in time, right? So, Talk to me a little bit. I'm always curious, father to father here. How is it? How do you think it's going to be over the next few years, raising the kiddos and getting them up into to school age and, you know, young adulthood, that you know, they're in a different environment than what we were when we were kids and that kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, as far as I can tell, and certainly in my experience, these kids of ours, you can preach and yell and scold, and you can talk about all the things you want them to do or how they want to behave. But at the end of the day, they learn by example. It's just how we're built, and it's how, you know, it's how they're wired. So, I'll be honest with you, really, this notion of holding yourself accountable for the person you want to be and the way you want to live your life. I mean, for me, that, you know, reached just a whole nother level when kids entered the picture.
Yeah.
That is like, I literally on a daily basis, will ask myself what am I showing my children? Way that I live my life. And I have, there's nothing I enjoy more. There's nothing that's more important to me, than my children. So, you know, it sucks a little bit, right? Suddenly accountability, you know, comes from a
direction. Yeah. I know what you mean. And you can't really like force the nuggets into their heads. They just watch and learn. And then a decade or so later, we'll start saying things that you've drilled into them.
You can't scream at your children that that they shouldn't lose their temper.
You guys are fantastic. How do you, and that brings us to another topic of even work-life balance. How do you balance that out with your kiddos and the missus and having so many other things that you're juggling too? I'm curious.
I got into this. My current business is a residential construction services company. And I was practicing law for a big, fancy, elite international law firm in 2010 when the triplets were born. And really was dissatisfied with the practice of law anyway. But on top of that, you know, said there's just no way I'm going to, you know, spend 90 hours a week doing this and not see my children. And living in an apartment in Manhattan, you know, with newborn triplets and a dog and a cat made no sense. So I, with a college roommate, I bought my current business, which was a small and sort of humble company when we bought it, primarily in search of a better quality of life for my family. And we moved from Manhattan down to Central Florida, where we live now, and started spending a lot more time at home, and had a house with a yard, and having dinner with my wife and all that. And it was great. And then, you know, as I said, just really blessed that my team and the timing and luck and our great customers and all that. I mean, the company's just succeeded beyond my wildest imagination. And rather than, you know, keep doubling down and tripling down and run the next thing and the next thing, I feel lucky that I was able to take a step back and say, you know what, the book's important to me. Sharing the vision is important to me. And by the way, now I get to, you know, at this point in my life, I get to spend a ton of time with my kids. I'm home a lot. Obviously I travel a lot too, to speak, but when I'm not traveling, I'm home. And, will I be involved in business again? You know, probably, almost certainly, but you know, for now it's great to have a lot of time with my kids. And, you know, that's kind of where I'm at.
Yeah. Did they get to go out on the road with you from time to time, things of that nature?
So they turned 7 in September. So they're still a little young. But the short answer is it's coming. I can't wait. They will start coming with me, which will be fun.
Yeah. My fourth of five, I labeled her my business partner. So even when she was still in, still in the car seat, and we'd be able to walk into a one-on-one meeting with some Fortune company, and she would just shake hands and eye contact and everything. So she's such a trip. So
that is awesome. I should say, before I get in trouble, we have a fourth child as well. We have a 19-month-old daughter.
Oh, wow.
Baby Clementine, who just dominates the house.
Yeah. Well, that's great.
Kind of want to go a little bit meta here and step back, take a little step back real quick. Wanted to kind of dissect a few things that you just talked about. For one, any other shows that you were talking about the construction company and how you've been able to multiply its effectiveness or just its ability by 10 times. Are there any things that you would want to kind of dive into how you were able to do that?
Sure. You know, we set out to build a company of excellence that we could be proud of. We set out to earn the loyalty and dedication of a team of hardworking folks. We set out to have a lot of fun with those folks while we were doing it, and to build a workplace where folks, you know, were part of something special. That was the goal. And we succeeded. The rest, I think, is largely, you know, icing on the cake. It's funny how that it often tends to happen that way in life, right? You know, there's these sort of virtuous cycles. But in terms of how I actually, you know, worked with the team and how we actually did it, you know, I think communication is a lost art. We have a hard time talking to each other, and we have a harder time listening to each other. And my blindness has given me some insight on that, and has helped me to work with my leadership team to, you know, communicate at a more meaningful and a sort of a deeper level. And there's, right. I could talk about that for days.
Well, and where I'm going with that is that what it sounds to me, and this is what, you know, my wife's in HR and, you know, she's been in a few companies herself and, you know, and even with the John Maxwell team that Al and I are both a part of, you know, one of the things that always comes up time and time again is culture, you know, and if your company has a culture, it's going to have a better time of staying alive than if it doesn't have one or if it has a negative one. I think a lot of that, what you're saying about communication there and people having the two way of communication adds to that culture.
There's no doubt about it. There's no doubt about it. People want and people deserve for their career, their employment to be, you know, more than, you know, punching a clock and counting the minutes and, you know, taking a paycheck. And that applies, you know, for anyone, any job, from the, you know, from the janitor to the CEO. Everybody wants that, and I think everyone deserves it. And it's the responsibility of the folks who lead organizations to, you know, to deliver that.
Being an undercover boss here, if you were in a management position and you wanted to help create culture in an organization, how can someone go about doing that?
So for me, it sort of starts fundamentally with the idea that, you know, you have a group of folks, let's take, you know, a leadership team at the top of it, you know, it cascades throughout the entire organization. But so let's start with the leadership team at the top. You know, this is a group of folks who have to understand, have to believe, have to live and breathe. You know, the idea that collectively they are responsible for the success of the organization, the goals of the organization. And yes, every member of the team has specific, discrete, you know, functions that they're responsible for, finance versus operations versus sales versus whatever. And yes, often, you know, there can be competing interests or views from the perspective of those, you know, discrete functions. But at some point in time, I think it should be weekly, at a minimum, but whatever, you all got to get in the room and communicate with each other from the perspective that collectively you are all responsible for the success of the overarching enterprise. And that is like where success begins and ends as a team. And, you know, from there, folks have to really be willing to be vulnerable, to communicate, to open up, to share ideas. And, you know, you've got to create a space where people are going to share their thoughts. So the person on the team who's responsible for your fleet of trucks and keeping them maintained and on the road, is going to weigh in on what he or she thinks about, you know, the sales strategy or the potential, you know, negotiation with the customer, the major issues that are going to impact the success or failure of the organization. Everyone's going to weigh in on it, and everyone has a perspective. That doesn't mean, by the way, that you make decisions all, you know, by vote or by consensus. Oftentimes, you know, the vote is made by fiat. That's why you have a leader. but certainly you need the discussion, because if you're not availing yourself of the perspectives, the insights, you know, of everyone on the team, you know, that reflects different parts of your organization, then, you know, you're flying blind.
Yeah.
Right. Right. In the other interviews that you've been on, you mentioned that your mom actually helped get you guys out of the deep hole that the business was going into with her savings. Thank you again, Mom.
Yes.
Did you ever get to pay her back?
Oh, yeah.
And what was her reaction? I mean, did she actually accept it?
Oh, yeah. No, it was a loan. And
okay.
It was a loan of her life savings at a time when most rational actors would not have made the loan. my mom literally never entertained any other possibility than that I would find success with my team fixing it. Digging out. Mm-hmm. And so to her, the repayment was almost a non-event, because she just never entertained any other possibility.
Mm. I was just kind of curious, because it's just, I don't know, there's just some folks that would have been like, yeah, good luck with that little thing, but I'm not gonna help. But good on your mom for being able to do that for you guys.
It's amazing.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Skipping forward a little bit. We've had plenty of TEDx presenters on the show, but specifically not anyone from the actual TED conference yet. And you kind of lumped it into a whole bunch of things that have been going on for you. But I would say that that's a big milestone in and itself.
Yeah.
How have you been able to kind of get, how would you get on to TED for one, and the different outlets and the podcasts that you've been on? Because again, I mean, from if it wasn't for the fact that you had been on, you know, Saved by the Bell early on in life, you might just be kind of thought of as a you know, super go-getter entrepreneur with his own construction company, but that doesn't necessarily put you in a thought leader slash person that's good on stage slash, you know, is going to be a great conversationalist for these different outlets that you've been on. How did you get involved with them?
Folks associated with the TED organization helped to coordinate and produce another event that I spoke at, a big international conference. There were, I don't know, 3,000 people there. It was in Dubai. And I gave a talk, and a couple months later got a call from one of these folks I mentioned, and they said, would you be willing to give a slightly longer version of that talk on the TED main stage? And I said, absolutely, sure.
No.
I've long been an enthusiastic consumer of TED Talks.
Yeah,
right. Built. And of course, the platform is unparalleled. So that's how it came about for me. I regret I don't have any real advice on how to make that happen. Not something I've studied much or thought about much. I've just kind of lucked into it. And asked for the thought leadership, or you know, I generally resist labels. I'll say this: for me, this is a deeply personal enterprise. This really is sharing my life and my blessings from the heart, and it means a lot to me, and that's why I'm doing it. You know, it's not about, you know, how I put food on the table. Thank God we're blessed when we have that covered. So, you know, this is something I do on the side because it's important to me,
which is awesome. Cool. So the different platforms and the different podcasts that you've been on, I mean, they've all been like big names. Were they all from the same group, or how'd you land on those, or
yeah,
any stories there?
So, you know, putting out a book, having the TED Talk, and then putting out the book, you know, was a pretty good 1-2 punch. And okay. In the process of working with my publisher to market the book.
Okay.
We scoured the earth.
Gotcha. So I was just kind of curious because a lot of people are always wondering, especially if they're trying to go down this path on purpose, do I want to self-publish or do I want to go with a publishing deal or something like that? And so that kind of goes into my next question is, how did you choose which publisher you wanted to go with? And what are some things that someone who is considering using a traditional publisher need to ask themselves before jumping in with someone?
You know, this is another one where I regret I don't actually feel super qualified to speak to. I don't know that I have any particular expertise. In my experience, I found a mentor and befriended him, and he ultimately became a close friend and a partner in this endeavor of mine. And he made some recommendations as to some publishers we might reach out to, and we did, and went up to New York and had a bunch of meetings, and it was kind of a Hollywood fairy tale type of situation. And three or four of them bid on the book, and it was awesome. The larger question of self-publishing or traditional publishing, or there's also kind of like a hybrid approach in the middle. I mean, I think it really depends on why you're writing the book and what you're trying to do with it. Maybe I'll just leave it at that.
Perfect. Here we are. I mean, shoot, you want to talk about a year flying by? I mean, 2017 is definitely going fast. What are you excited about in the future?
I am excited about everything in the future. right now I'm really enjoying sharing Eyes Wide Open with folks reading the amazing things people write through my website or via email, and corresponding with folks, and I'm really enjoying this, and I'll keep doing it so long as I still think I'm adding value for folks. I think I will probably be involved in more business ventures, down the road. But for now, I'm sort of living in the moment. And what will I be doing in 2 or 3 years? I have absolutely no idea. And I love that. I think
that's a good answer.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's true.
I know it. I know what you mean. So you just mentioned a mentor that turned into a partner and so on that took you along that path. Do you have 2 or 3 other influencers in your life that you would say have been there for you and guided you?
Oh, there's no question. So, I mean, first and foremost, and above all, it's a different, different league, different sport entirely, would be my wife, Dorothy, who's my everything partner. Anyway, I could go on about Dorothy for a long time, but so, her and then, yeah, I've been blessed to have a lot of great mentors and role models in my life. I worked for, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, U.S. Supreme Court Justice. And she is a remarkable woman and on every level, and was just so good to me and taught me so much. And on and on, of course, my mom and my sisters and friends I've leaned on throughout the years.
Good deal. What is something from the 90s you wish was still a thing?
Something from the 90s I wish was still a thing. Something from that. Should have to think back to the 90s, I guess.
Not even Snapple caps?
Yeah.
Snapple caps?
Oh, that's funny.
Pumps, I don't miss those. Yeah. Z Cabarichis, I don't know. Those are probably a good thing those are gone. I don't know. Snap hands or whatever. Those were big, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Saved by the Bell? I don't know. That's pretty bad, Phil.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you think is a basic life skill that you're shocked that people don't have these days?
Introspection.
Touche. That was, it's like you know about it, like you've got some experience with that. Yeah.
What is something you believed as a 20-year-old that you'd now tell yourself is completely inaccurate, and why?
Oh, that I had some control over the world and my life and fate and circumstances. We have no control. we experience an illusion of control in many ways. It's very productive. It's evolutionarily, it's very useful, but we really are not in control.
I've got one final one for you. What does it mean to you to live a life of abundance?
For me, I mean, that's an easy one. I mean, the joy, well-being, respect of my children. is really what I'm in it for.
Yeah. All right. So, you know, a lot of things have been, you've been asked a lot of questions on various podcasts, including the ones that I've listened to and today, that really seem to be pretty far out there for, again, a lot of people, including going to Harvard, which now that we know, you actually had sisters that were previously there and knew the way how to get there, serving as a law clerk for two Supreme Justices and working in Manhattan, even speaking at the main TED conference, which there was a little bit of a setup there, and maybe you just got to have to figure out the different steps to get there. What are a few things that you would recommend someone can start doing today in reaching bigger goals in life and what you seem to be achieving quite regularly? How can they set themselves up for that success?
Sure. So there's a mentor and role model of mine, a gentleman named Jack Daly, who I think is just awesome. And you know, I'm going to probably butcher this, but you know, he always talks about like, what you got to start with, what is the goal? Where are you trying to get? And then like, we can figure out how to get there. Or we can talk about how to get there, but you know, you got to define where you want to get. So for me, I would encourage folks to ask themselves, what do you want out of life? What is the kind of person you want to be? How do you want to spend your life? What kind of father do you want to be, or mother? What kind of spouse? What kind of child? What kind of parent? How do you want to spend your time? What is important to you? And, you know, these are big questions. I get it. And it's easy to roll your eyes and be like, yeah, yeah, yeah. But, you know, I got to cover the mortgage and whatever. But, you know, this is the thing. We are answering those questions every moment we're here, whether we like it or not, want to admit it or not, you know, whether we realize it or not, you know, we're answering those questions every minute we're here. So what I would encourage people to do is, you know, take some time and you know, at least answer those questions with awareness and intention and purpose and figure out what's important to you. And, you know, the rest is details. But, it, you know, it's got to start there.
Mm. And where can people find you if they want to learn more about your book and just what you're up to?
Sure. So the best place to go is probably my website, which is just mylastname.com. So it's Lidsky, L as in Larry, I, D as in David, S as in Sam, KY.com. And I have a blog there, an interview series with some really exciting guests. And you can get more information about the book. You can see the TED Talk. It's all right there. The one thing that I ask is if you are interested and you do check it out, please, please, please let me know what you think, you know, agree or disagree. Does any of this resonate with you? What are your ideas? Because, you know, there's wisdom in community, and I would really love to hear from you. I read every single submission to the website and intend to keep doing so. So I would love to hear from you.
Well, thank you so much for being on today. Definitely wanting different flavor of show, because I was trying to be a little bit more creative about questions and topics that we went into, so you didn't feel like you were having to say the same things over. But yeah, definitely good chat, and appreciate your time. Al's being quiet over here. Come on, dude.
Yeah, thanks, Isaac. Appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Thanks, guys.
Well, there you have it, guys. Isaac is a really interesting guy, and I think there's a few more layers of him that we weren't quite able to quite look at yet. I mean, he's only a couple of years older than me, but you can tell he's had a full life of getting things done and reflection. And while I haven't heard it yet, I do know that our friend Gregory Deal did an interview of Isaac's as well, and so you can go on over there and listen to that show if you want to hear more from Isaac in podcast form. Speaking of podcasts, what do you guys think of this format? A little different than we usually do, not too far off of the norm. But how'd you guys like it? Let us know at heyguys@newinceptions.com, or you know, you can let me know directly what you thought or what you got out of this conversation by sending me a tweet at JC_Preston. Remember, we really like those reviews on Stitcher, SoundCloud, and iTunes, and any of them that we're going to get, we'll read them at the front of the show. And in the extras in this session, I have some videos of Isaac so you can get to know him a bit more. The first one is of his appearance on The Doctors, and I'll also have his TED Talk as well. Another video I wanted to highlight is the one that he did for the YPO, the Young Presidents Organization. And if you don't know much about this organization, I did do a little bit of research, and You know, I got to say, as entrepreneurs and creatives, it might be worth your while to check out. So I'll have a link to that in the show notes. Definitely something that you might want to get involved with yourself. And finally, since we really didn't discuss it that much in the interview, I wanted to show him as his role as Weasel in Saved by the Bell. And, you know, having been a 90s kid myself, I loved the original. I didn't know too much about this series, but I love the original. And not to geek out, but, you know, it's cool getting the chance to talk to someone that was part of the overall cast. So pretty cool to be able to have that experience. So in next week's show, Daniel Postma will be making a stop by. And, you know, we haven't really heard from him too much recently. And, you know, the reason why that he's stopping by is that we're going to be getting to interview a friend of his and many of the guests that we've had on the show. And his name is Eric Finnegan. And like Daniel and I, Eric spent some time in the foundation. And needless to say, you know, he really changed his life. And in 2 years, he went from being a super successful corporate guy to being a location independent entrepreneur. He went from socially anxious and awkward to being, well, what I'd call a leader, because most of the people that are in the foundation that know of him think of him as such. And, you know, he went from being terrified of relationships to actually thriving in them. And he went from being generally depressed as a whole to being grateful, appreciative, and mostly happy. And we're going to find out how he was able to go through all those changes in those 2 short years. So, you know, I hope you guys enjoy it, get a lot out of it. And, you know, to be honest with you, 2 years is all it took. I mean, there's no reason why you can't change your life around in that a short amount of time yourself. So anyway, make sure you're informed when that session is published. All you have to do is like the New Inceptions page on Facebook, and then underneath the following tab, just select See First. So guys, that's it for session 102. Thanks for listening in with us today. And again, remember that if you don't want to read all of your books, you can have some of them summarized for you via Read It For Me. Check out newinceptions.com/readitforme to try out your free membership so you can get those daily texts. And guys, that said, thanks for joining Isaac, Al, and myself in this chat. Until next time, gang, dig in, have fun, take care in whatever you're creating. And we'll see you back here next time.
Thanks for listening to the Angles of Latitude podcast. Connect with us at home, at work, or on the go at facebook.com/newinceptions, on Twitter @newinceptions, Instagram @new.inceptions, and on the web at newinceptions.com.